Sarah, good afternoon. Police are to be given new powers to impose conditions on repeated protests and consider their impact on the community. Yesterday, almost 500 people were arrested at a protest in support of the banned group Palestine Action in London. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, says she was acting close the gap in the law concerning frequent demonstrations held in the same locations.
What I'm allowing is for the police to be able to take cumulative disruption into account, and it is important, I think, that we make this change so that the right balance can be struck between allowing people the freedom to protest, which is an ancient freedom in this country, but balancing that against the rights of the wider community to be able to go about their business free from intimidation and fear.
Police in Sussex are treating a fire which damaged a mosque in Peacehaven last night as a hate crime. The front entrance to the building and a vehicle parked outside were damaged. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says she'll set up a new agency to deport 150,000 illegal migrants every year if her party wins the next election. Speaking in Manchester ahead of the Tory conference, she said she had a credible plan which would also ban people arriving on small boats from claiming asylum and would take the UK out of the European Convention on Human Rights. Mrs. Badenoch brushed aside questions about where people would be sent.
I'm tired of us asking all of these irrelevant questions about where should they go. They will go back to where they should do or another country, but they should not be here. They will go back to where they came from. That's what they need to do. We cannot have a situation where we can't deport people and say, well, we don't know where they go, so they can just stay here. That is basically inviting every single person across the world to our shores.
Hope is building in Israel as indirect talks on the release of hostages are due to get underway in Egypt tomorrow. The Israeli Prime Minister said he hoped to announce the freeing of those held in Gaza in the coming days. Officials in Poland say jets were scrambled to protect its airspace during overnight Russian attacks on western Ukraine. The governor of the Lviv region said two people were killed in the strikes. The weather staying blustery in places, sunny spells and patchy clouds, some showers in the west, top temperatures of 17 Celsius in London, 15 in Cardiff, 14 in Edinburgh and Belfast. That's the BBC News and weather. It's now 2 minutes past 12 and time on BBC Radio 3 for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The pioneering choreographer Shobhana Jair Singh has produced more than 60 original works, many of them created for outdoors or for unusual settings. She was born in India and came to England in her late teens to study English literature at Sussex University. She had learned classical Indian dance as a child, and in her early 20s she drew on that passion, touring first as a dancer and then founding her own dance company in 1989 to develop her own work. Since then, she's collaborated with scientists, filmmakers, and numerous composers, including Erilyn Wallen, Kevin Volans, and Michael Nyman. Her most recent work is inspired by The Tempest and views Shakespeare's story through the eyes of Caliban, the so-called monstrous slave. You've brought Shobhana some very wide-ranging music, including Mozart and Messiaen, Arvo Pärt, but I think we're going to begin with Purcell.
That's right. So I first encountered this music because I was doing a bit of research for a film that I've made, actually on cell division, on mitosis, and I realised there was a really dramatic activity, the way these little filaments called microtubules had to find the chromosomes, which are in the centre of the cell. But actually, from what I understood from the scientists, it wasn't a done deal. There was a huge struggle. So I was looking for some music that actually had that sense of struggle, drama, suspense. And really, I really couldn't think of a better one than the Call Song.
And it actually has the feeling of an idea multiplying and dividing, doesn't it?
Correct, yes. And what I sort of found in it is just a kind of ascending drama, and actually it sort of takes you higher and higher emotionally. And I just love Andreas Scholl's voice.
He is splendid here, and it's such a striking, visionary sound, isn't it, for somebody in Purcell's era?
Yeah, I mean, it's so amazingly modern.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you don't have to like retune your head to a historical era in order to appreciate it, or even culturally, really. There's something so contemporary about the way he crafts the music, the structure and the emotion being so symbiotic. I think that's why it's such a successful piece of music. I think there was actually, strangely, there was a punk version of this song, and you can see why.
It looks forward centuries to minimalism, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It's a kind of repetitive, insistent, but I would never say it's mechanical. There's something about it which is also emotionally, it sort of keeps sending you forwards, and there's a resolution, but actually what you remember most is the journey, you know.
What Power Art Thou? The Cold Song, an aria from the 17th century opera King Arthur by Henry Purcell, performed by Andreas Scholl with the Accademia Byzantina, conducted by Stefano Montanari. Shobana, tell us a little bit about your early life, because you were born in Chennai in India.
Yes, I was born in Chennai, but then my father actually lived in Sri Lanka, so my primary schooling was in Sri Lanka. And it was a very particular kind of upbringing, just because at that point it was called the Socialist Republic of Sri Lanka. It was an incredibly self-sufficient country. One didn't have many imports. I think as a kind of a fight back against colonial education, the Sri Lankan government actually said every child had to be educated in their own mother tongue, even though we could have English as a second language. So it was a somewhere place as opposed to an anywhere kind of place, you know. And then later on, because of political reasons, because of, you know, the civil war, my parents moved to East Malaysia, which is another very unusual place, because many people think about Malaysia as mainland Malaysia, you know, Kuala Lumpur, but East Malaysia actually is near Indonesia. So when I lived there, it was relatively uncrowded. We lived on a beautiful beach. And then I went to a school where the medium of instruction was English, but every single person in my class apart from me was Chinese.
But you were sent to boarding school at an early age.
Yeah, I was six and a bit. In Sri Lanka, I went to boarding school. But then when I went to Malaysia in my teens, I was staying at home.
The boarding school was quite a strict place.
It was. It was run like an English public school, really. We all had to get up at 5:45 in the morning and have a cold shower. It was meant to be character forming. One very quickly learned the trick of turning the shower on, but actually standing wrapped in your towel quite far from it.
Yes, you were using the imagination from an early age. You were a voracious reader.
Yes, I loved reading from... Actually, my mother was a maths teacher, and I think she was a bit disappointed that actually words seemed to inspire me far more than numbers. She got her maths degree when she was 19, so she must have been obviously very good at it. When I was young, I just found myself reading all kinds of books, you know, books in Tamil, books in English. I had an unusual library as a child because I grew up in what's called upcountry Sri Lanka, where all the tea estates are. And most of the tea estates actually were managed by Scottish people, you know, because they were the huge colonial administrators. So all the tea estates are Scottish names like Dunbar, Glasgow, Murray, Blinkbonny, even there was an estate called Blinkbonny. And so one of my father's friends, who was a Scottish planter, he gave me his son's entire library when they finally left Sri Lanka. I was reading as if I were actually living somewhere in Edinburgh because I just had this child's books to read, which none of my Sri Lankan friends did.
And was a music important to your early life? Was it there at school? Did you learn an instrument?
Well, I learned the piano, but I also listened to a lot of Indian classical music because I did Indian classical dance. It was a brilliant school because it had dance in its curriculum. So every week, apart from language and maths and other stuff, we also had a dance lesson and we learned folk dance. We had Sri Lankan Kandyan dance and then privately I learned Bharatanatyam, which is a South Indian classical dance. So I grew up listening to both types of music. You know, we sang, it was a very Christian school, so we sang hymns three times a day. So I kind of grew up with these two musical languages in my head.
The next piece you've chosen has a very spiritual aspect to it, doesn't it? It's by Ovo Pärt.
Yeah. I love this piece of music, The Woman with the Alabaster Box, just because, as a story from the Bible, I think it's such a poetic and philosophic story of the woman with the expensive perfume, which she puts on Christ's feet and then wipes it with her hair. And then his disciples say, well, what a waste of money, because you could sell it and feed so many poor people. But I think Christ celebrates that poetic action, which has no practical value, if you want to be pedantic about it, but actually it has got incredible symbolic and spiritual value, you know, and I think the music captures that. I mean, I heard it once in an empty church, and the way the voices just filled the building was just such an incredible experience. I've never forgotten it. It sort of reminds me of certain aspects of Indian classical music because there's one part which is not still, but it's just resonant, a bit like a bell.
Or a drone.
Yeah, like a drone. And then there's another part which is kind of moving in relationship to it. I think that's probably what I unconsciously connected to.
Thank you. I was thinking as we were listening to that Shobhana Singh that the drone, as it were, doesn't have to be at the bottom. People always think that, you know, it's with like a bagpipe or something. But there we had it on the top of the texture.
Yeah.
And that probably corresponds to movement.
It does. I mean, you're so right. But I think here you kind of see it rising. Mm. And I think that's what sort of creates a sense of movement too. And it's amazing how he forces your ear to listen. It's a bit like going through lots of different rooms, you know. That's how I feel. And, of course, it's different when you listen to it in a church, maybe a Gothic church. So I'm also aware of the architecture because I put myself in that Gothic shape of this triangle that's going ever upwards, you know, and you're kind of... Or a church bell, you know. I think church bells have that quality of movement and stillness. It gives you an amazing space for your ear to inhabit. I mean, it reminds me of, I think there's a famous poem by Donne where he talks about music, you know, this kind of perfect stillness, but without it being static, you know. And this music really, when I listen to it, that's what makes me feel.
Didn't you create a piece to be done in the pews of a church?
So, yes, I had this wonderful opportunity to make a piece inside a church. And obviously, when you think about liturgical dancing, you kind of think about people processing in the aisle. But actually, it's the furniture of the pew that really interested me, because I'd always wanted to be a filmmaker. And I thought, actually, if I had dancers in the pews, when you make things for stage, you can't really say cut and people disappear. You've got to spend a lot of time thinking about transitions. But when you had this pew, actually, you could say cut and people dropped down and you wouldn't see them anymore. So they popped up or they vanished from view. And in fact, we started the piece where the dancers were lying on the floor and audience were actually in the chancel steps where the priest would be. So the audience were looking at the building from the priest's point of view. It was fun to make.
We heard The Woman with the Alabaster Box by Arvo Pärt, performed by the choir of Clare College, Cambridge, conducted by Graham Ross. Shobana, when you came back from school, What kind of things would you get up to?
I'd read a lot. I just loved reading poetry to myself. Now, it sounds a bit sad, but because I lived by a beach, I spent a lot of time on my own, walking on the beach and thinking about... Actually, I was really crazy about Shelley.
Romantic poet.
Yes.
And cinema, was that something you developed a love of?
Well, the way we saw dance when we were kids is a lot through Indian cinema. The early Indian cinema in the 60s and 70s, they used classical dancers as their heroines because they were looking for women who were used to performing, and the close-up was a huge thing. So, you know, you wanted people whose faces were mobile, who were used to acting and portraying emotions. So most of the people you admired as a child who seemed like goddesses were these film stars. So one of those film stars was this lady called Kamala Lakshmanan, who was a brilliant Indian classical dancer. And I used to read about her in magazines and I thought, you know, I'd love to go and learn from her teacher, which actually finally I did manage to, called Valuvu Ramayapalli in Chennai. Yeah.
So the first style of dancing that you were involved in was what?
South Indian classical dance, which is called Bharatanatyam, from age of six.
And the aspect of that that's very noticeable is to do with hands, feet, eyes.
Yeah, they play an important part. It's not that it's the core script, if you like, but it uses every part of the body, you know, neck, fingers, because obviously when you think about it, your hands got incredible number of moving parts. So it uses all those things to pattern the body, really. So it's a kind of like sophisticated pattern making. And because it's a soloist, you have to utilize everything that the body offers, you know, because you don't have a huge ensemble of dancers covering the stage. You only have that single human body. That's why eyes, neck, fingers, they all become part of it. But when people see it in the West, because they're not used to seeing that amount of detail, it's what catches your eye. But I think the main thing about Indian classical dance is this use of weight. So like ballet, the sort of main thing one feels is that, you know, there's a yearning to be released from gravity. So the sense of, you know, you try and make the body float and the energy sort of float away from the body. But in Indian classical dance, the energy is kind of brought back into the center and the whole physical body is sort of more rooted. You're very aware of the flow and the fact that your feet are actually gripping the flow, not trying to get away from it.
Fascinating. And I think the next piece of music is Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys.
It is. I mean, it reminds me of the beach that I lived by in East Malaysia. And within the pop genre, you know, 3 minutes, they certainly take you to so many different places and they kind of surprise you in a way. I also think it's rather ironic that this man who wrote the music hated surfing and probably didn't like going to the beach. He was deaf in one ear and he was a drug addict with mental problems. And what you hear is just absolutely the opposite. You know, this beautiful, idyllic sound of waves and beach and tanned bodies and eternal sunshine. It just goes to show that art making
transcends.
Yeah, correct.
Transcends circumstance, yes.
Yeah. Or you can't be like the art you make, I guess. You know?
No, it's like a little masterpiece.
It is. I love the colourful clothes you wear
And the way the sunlight plays upon her head. I hear the sound of a gentle word on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Somehow closer now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. When I look in her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations.
Extraordinary song, isn't it? And even with the words, they have that sort of playful idea of, for example, she gives me excitations to rhyme with vibrations.
Well, I guess it's better than rhyming kiss with miss, which is what usually happens in pop songs.
Exactly. As an avid reader, Shobhanajot Singh, did you enjoy secondary school?
I did. I was very lucky, actually, in my school. I had a brilliant literature teacher, actually only qualified to teach home science and how to make cakes. But she obviously loved reading and loved literature. And probably it's because of her that I ended up studying English literature at university. But it was a sort of a surreal experience because the school was actually right next to this tropical beach. And yet we were reading about daffodils, went to the lakeside poets. And so it kind of added to the pleasure, you know, because actually one had to imagine even harder what it would be like to see a host of golden daffodils when you saw hibiscus or palm trees. And so I just thought, really, I need to go to England and, you know, look at a daffodil in the eye, see what the Lake District was about and what inspired these poets, you know. And Sussex at the time, their English department was amazing because actually it was started by some rebels from Oxford.
There was a T.S. Eliot poem that you became particularly fond of, Four Quartets.
Yeah, the Four Quartets, I have a copy of it in my desk and I dip in. It's such a brilliant poem. Amazingly musical, as well as intellectually and spiritually challenging.
You know? And pointing to dance, of course.
Yes, that's right.
At the still point of the turning world, which correct. Ends with there would be no dance and there is only the dance.
Correct. That's a very profound statement. Yeah, he looked at dance as a sort of metaphor. And actually also there's a wonderful line where he talks about going to this village and seeing his ancestors maybe dancing around the fire. And he says clay feet, loam feet, and this sort of idea of dead people like nourishing the corn. So the dance kind of, it's a sort of sign of our continuity and connectedness to nature. And folk dance, you know, people coming to dance together, a communal sense of life, you know.
I think you love the way people sometimes perform music with a sense of dance, even in their movements. And the next piece is an example of that. It's a Mozart concerto for piano and orchestra.
So I love this piece played by Yolum Sun. To me, watching her perform is really like seeing a dancer and a poet at the same time. She is so completely within the music. And when she plays, the way she moves her arm is so dance-like. The way her hands come off the keyboard and then go back to it again, the weight that she gives to each finger. And I think this particular piece, I just thought it was such a sublime piece of music. You know, like sometimes you just find things which are just beautiful that actually you really can't analyze why you find it beautiful. I must have listened to it one day when I was waking up because I just remember it sort of changing the day for me.
Thank you.
The Andante from Mozart's Concerto for Piano and Orchestra in C Major, performed by Yolum Son, the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, directed by Neville Marin. I can't help wondering, Chopiner, since you so love that music and that performance, whether you think of choreography when you hear it. Do you think it's something you would like to choreograph?
It's funny, actually. Most of the time, the music that you like, you don't really think about, at least for me, I don't automatically think I'd love to choreograph for that. Actually, I don't think I could choreograph to that, because the kind of movement that inspires me is actually the opposite to what the music does, because the music is very caressing. Whereas in terms of movement for choreography, I'm actually interested in resistance rather than surrender. You know, here there's a kind of like a surrender to the tone and to the space around you. That's what the music seems to be leading me to, a kind of surrender. But in movement, actually, my interests are absolutely the opposite. So
that's really interesting. I mean, knowing your work, I'm fascinated that you make that distinction.
Yeah, well, in the studio, I often tell my dancers the starting point is don't take space for granted. It's not given that the space is your friend, you know, so you have to fight to make yourself heard in the space with your limbs, you know. I think that comes from me being an Asian woman in Britain. That's the dynamic, that's my currency in some ways. So that's what I love about this piece, is that it kind of gives me a sort of release from that.
When you came here to this country, did you feel there was an element of friction?
Well, not in a sort of obvious sense, you know, because my command of English was good.
But socially, I mean, how did you find the UK coming here?
I think people were incredible. I was at Sussex. People were incredibly polite. I was the only person doing English literature in the School of English and American Studies who was Indian. So actually, people were especially kind. But, you know, inevitably, in certain situations, one had to strive. You know, it's a bit like swimming upstream. But it's also being a female. One can't really separate why that feeling of swimming upstream, performing against a current, that's always been the case. But, you know, there are probably many, many reasons. As you get older, you can't help but understand that actually the reason I'm here as an Indian person talking to you in English is because of a whole colonial history that has gone on before. And I don't think of it as a sort of a stick to beat people with, because it's a shared history. But I kind of feel that actually the more people understand it in a more equitable way, the better the chances are of people getting together. So I think it's really important for people to understand colonial histories from both perspectives, because they're very, very different. So I think no matter how kind people were, and they were very kind, some or other, it's that imbalance of information, the imbalance of power that, you know, that can't help but influence the way one's life is shaped. You know, it's like in that novel Passage to India. You know, there are two great friends. There's Aziz, the Muslim doctor, and then the Englishman. But in the end, I think they gallop away on their horses in different directions, because this is understanding, you know, no matter how much they get on as people, there is something historical that's actually stopping them being true friends.
Yes, fascinating. You worked actually as a teacher of English, didn't you, for a while?
For a while, yeah.
And I wonder how you made the move into dance from there.
The language school where I taught, it used to be a ballet school, so it had this beautiful sprung floor. So I got permission from the principal to come after school and practice. And so it was a kind of a gradual shift away to doing something that I just loved doing. But actually, as I did it more and more, I realised I was not that happy being a dancer. First of all, I didn't think I was a particularly wonderful dancer, though I really wanted to be and tried very hard. I was never really satisfied. And also, you know, my interest has always been in the designing of dance as opposed to the performing of dance. So I was far more curious. Though I remember my dance teacher telling me, don't analyse, that's the death of grace. That's what he used to tell me. But actually, I couldn't help it. I wanted to analyse. I wanted to know how things were put together, you know, why if you did it this way, it had this particular emotional effect. If you had it this way, it had something. So I was always interested in the mechanics of dance design.
We're going to hear Indian classical music next, featuring the veena. What is the veena?
Actually, Indian classical music, there are two schools or two traditions. So North India is called Hindustani music. There's more chance of people hearing, say, tabla and sitar. South Indian music, which is what we're going to hear, Carnatic music, uses another stringed instrument, which is, you know, a bit like a sitar. It's an old lute, really. So it's a stringed instrument which you have to sit down and play.
But the veena player, Kalpakam Swaminathan, she's a very famous player.
Yeah, she's famous, and she played veena till she was quite old. Mm. I just find her an amazing musician and a kind of role model, really. So in a typical classical music concert, you'll find everyone nodding their heads and everyone counting, because there are very particular ways of engaging with the rhythmic structure.
Towards the end of the piece, which we're going to hear now, we get the more percussive, faster music.
Correct. And in this particular piece of music, the count is Misra Chapu, which is a 7-beat rhythm. So when you listen to it, you're also appreciating how the 7-beat rhythm is established and then played around with and exploited.
Shankari Nine, composed by Mysore Vasudevacha and performed by Kalpakam Swaminathan. You explained earlier how, for you, moving to choreography was kind of a natural thing. But how did you carve out a career in the UK? It must have taken a lot of determination.
First of all, just being incredibly interested. I mean, I still find that, you know, when I go to a studio and I start thinking about movements, you know, it's still the most wonderful privilege to be able to do that. It really is just doing what one loves, you know.
Nevertheless, setting up a company, which you did in 1989, is no small thing.
No, well, that's the sort of drawback of choreography. I mean, if you're a composer nowadays, you probably need a laptop, maybe a piano, and a room to yourself, ditto writer, painter, but the minute you want to do choreography, you have to make a social contract because it involves other people. Choreography doesn't exist without an audience, you know. You can't do it in your attic. It's got to be public. It's about real time. So that is why you have to create a structure and a platform to show your choreography. So I remember sitting next to this barrister at a dinner table and him saying, I love going to contemporary dance because at the end of a hard day, my brain can never rest. And that's exactly the opposite to why I like contemporary dance, because it's also a medium for interrogation. It's a medium for expressing thoughts. But I think in Britain, our traditions are very literary. And dance really, in a way, it has to struggle to assert itself as an intellectual activity as well as a pleasure-giving activity, you know. Often people think of dance as, participatory, which is great, you know, healthy, but it's also a medium of thought.
Mm-hmm. Couperin next.
Yes, Couperin. I did my MA in Shakespeare Studies, and actually I did it on The Tempest, and I was kind of interested in magic and science, you know, because they were kind of at loggerheads at the time. So I was reading a lot about witchcraft and the witch trials, and I spent a lot of time in Edinburgh, and the flat where I was staying in also included somebody who played the harpsichord a lot. And that was the first time, actually, I heard the harpsichord. I was just amazed. And he played this piece over and over again. And I just grew to love it, the sound of the harpsichord and Baroque music, because, again, it reminded me a little bit of Indian classical music, just because of the seriousness that it gave ornamentation. It didn't really come from personal feelings, you know, of joy or sadness or whatever. It really just came from expressing music, you know. But it was also emotional. I think that's what I find really fascinating. It's where structure and emotion are in perfect balance. And then I realized, because it is a chaconne, which is a dance form, but then it's also called the complaint. And so it has got that sort of yearning, slightly melancholic quality. So I guess it's up to the player which one he privileges. So it can sound like a dance, depending on what tempo he wants to play it, or it can sound like the complaint.
Well, we're going to hear Christopher Hogwood.
Yes.
And you must tell us afterwards which version you've heard. Couperin's Chaconne in D minor, played on the harpsichord by Christopher Hogwood. And now I have to ask Shobhanajaya Singh, which side did he come down on, would you say?
It's very difficult to say, actually, because I think it was more like a dance. It's quite slow and magisterial. Maybe he was trying to steer a, you know,
a middle course.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about the course you were steering with your first production on Dior Own Name. Miniatures, which became configurations.
Yes, actually, that was my first attempt at like contemporary choreography, but still using Indian classical dance technique. But I wanted to just try and see what happens if the music was not Indian classical dance music. So by chance, Michael Nyman, I think, happened to be in a concert where I was dancing, and someone overheard him in the bar later saying he quite liked the way music was used in this Indian dance. So in those days, it was quite easy. You just had to phone him up and go over to his house and explain what he wanted to do. So I said to him, look, you know, I will give you all the rhythms written down. So I had sort of graph paper and I wrote 6 movements. And the second one, I think, was my favourite because I decided to do a 20-beat rhythm cycle, which could either be heard as 5s or 4s. And I thought he did that really cleverly. I really loved this particular movement. And when I had my dancers, they would get really very, very confused because obviously, you know, Indian music, this kind of information will be coming at you through a percussive instrument, so it's much easier to count.
For example, the drum often leads, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, for any kind of counter. Yeah, there was nothing percussive or countable. I think the 5s were in the cello and then the 4s were in the violin, and, you know, people had to really listen. I think he did say at that time it was like composing with one hand tied behind his back, because not only did I say this is going to have this pattern, 4 and 5, and they meet every 20, but also how many 4s and how many 20s. So he probably was a bit like being in a straitjacket. Thank you.
I could see you counting furiously. We heard the second part of the String Quartet No. 2, composed by Michael Diamond, performed by the Balanescu Quartet. Shobhanajay Singh, after the 2005 London bombings, you choreographed a piece called Fault Line, which included contemporary dance, martial arts and classical Indian dance, performed over an electronic score by Robin Rambo with a soprano singer, Patricia Rosario. Mm. She occasionally appeared on stage and her haunting voice lent a deeply eerie quality to the piece. What were you trying to achieve in that?
Yes, one actually only knows what one's trying to achieve years later. It was a very strange time for young Indian men, a few of whom were in my company at that time, because wherever they went, there was this feeling of suspicion. I think people just viewed them as kind of dangerous beings. And one of them actually was happened to be waiting just outside St. Paul's, and a policeman basically came to question him. And he gave him a piece of paper which explained why, and he said, loitering in front of an iconic building. So, Fault Line was about that kind of feeling of discomfort about the Asian presence. And musically, Robin's professional name is Scanner, so he did this electronic score. And I also wanted a live element, so I brought in Erlyn Wallen. And so both these elements really kind of sat on top of each other. And I think what I wanted to stage was this feeling of anxiety and of tension, which certainly I felt during that time.
I imagine, Shobhana, that the next piece, this famous Welsh hymn, is inspired by personal connections.
Yes, because I'm married to a Welshman, and he's a Welsh-speaking Welshman from mid-Wales. And even though I'd read Welsh poets and Robert Graves, it was a surprise to me to find a Welsh community and family in mid-Wales whose first language was very much Welsh. And they were very different culturally to the Anglo-Saxon culture that I had known so much about. And it's a very communal culture, in love with language.
And singing.
Singing, yes. Everybody sings with their heart and soul. Hymns, you know, chapel going, though of course nowadays, you know, a lot of the chapels unfortunately are in disuse. But my Welsh family, they gave me such a tremendous welcome. So we're going to hear the great, probably the greatest Welsh hymn, Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer, which obviously you can hear in every rugby match.
Cwm Rhondda.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're going to hear it performed by Bryn Terfel, the Black Mountain Choir, the Risca Choir, Welsh National Opera, directed by Gareth Jones. Dymar llawydd ar amor.
Wenn Hornheimelis Süden tarrier greig im Eis, Wider Aniel meis kan lönnet, Avon jachau dur jaith gras.
Well, that had us both singing, didn't it? Cwm Rhondda, composed by John Hughes and performed by Bryn Terfel, the Black Mountain Choir, the Risker Choir, Welsh National Opera Orchestra, all directed by Gareth Jones. Shobhana Singh, in 2000 you developed Guillain-Barré syndrome, which meant you had to use a wheelchair for a while. I know a bit about this because I had a version called Miller-Fisher syndrome, and it really is where the immune system attacks the sheath of the nerves. So it's rather like if you've got an electric cable and you take off the rubber surrounding it. This must have been terribly difficult for somebody so used to dance and movement, and now you're in a wheelchair.
Yeah, no, it was a horrific part of my life. Luckily, I was still able to choreograph. So I remember going into the studio with two sticks at one point. But it was the most horrible of illnesses because it is rare. Actually, in a way, as a choreographer, you are very aware of bone and muscle, because most injuries happen to bone and muscle. You know, people twist their ankles or tear their muscle. But actually, it's funny, the whole part of your body, which is the nervous system, you know, people don't give it a lot of attention. But you realise, you know, it's like someone switching off the current, and suddenly you could have the best muscle and bone, but nothing works because there's nothing to give it life and movement. So it was a shock. You know, I was in hospital for 3 months. It does gradually get better. But
well, that's where it's unlike MS, which it's related to in some ways. Yeah. It will get better. That's Did you have problems breathing?
No, luckily. So if it comes all the way to your intercostal muscles, that's when you have to have a ventilator. For me, it kind of stopped in my hip bone. So it's actually just my legs that were mostly affected. But it really, especially my left leg, you know, it took lots and lots of physiotherapy to get it back to what I considered normal. But of course, if you're in the dance world, normal's a bit different. You don't just want to walk, you want to plie. You know, with dance particularly, one's always used to pain because it's a kind of work where you have to push your body. It's really about redeeming your body from what you'd say normalcy, because you've got to push your body to do extraordinary things. You know, you train for years. But recovering was, you know, if you say the normal body was ground zero and dance, you've got to get it up to 100. Guillain-Barré was like minus 100. But you could kind of see a pathway. So that was the journey. But it's almost felt like the journey I'd been to before in some ways, but now it was harder.
Well, it's Messiaen next, the seventh movement from The Birth of the Lord, organ suite. What draws you to his music, which is an extraordinary mixture of almost innocent naivety and total belief?
It's very bombastic, I guess, you know, I could think about it like that. I mean, I just love the organ, I have to say. It's such an amazing, well, it's a very bombastic instrument, really. And it's there to fill this amazing space and sort of rattle your eardrums. But this particular piece, I heard a friend of mine sadly passed away during COVID. And so for his funeral, there were only 30 people who were allowed into this church. And they played this movement at the end of the service. It's quite strange because it's about nativity. And yet in the middle of, you know, angels and shepherds and whatnot, you suddenly have this very seemingly dark passage. But in some ways, I think you can be given the license to be extreme just because of your instrument and the place where you're playing it, you know? If it was outside in a town square, it maybe might not work.
No, keep Coombe Rondo for there. And we have the organ music in the monastery or the cathedral.
Yeah, that's right.
Jesus Accepts Suffering, the seventh movement from The Birth of the Lord, the organ suite composed by Olivier Messiaen in 1935 and performed there by Marie-Claire Alain. You're about to tour Shobhanajaya Singh, a show called We Caliban, drawing on Shakespeare's plays The Tempest. Caliban, of course, is a native inhabitant of the island where Prospero and Miranda are shipwrecked. What is your sort of take on this?
I think my take is obviously quite obvious in some ways, because it's the story of a nobleman from Europe who goes to this island which is unknown to him, and he finds the native of the island who obviously looks different to him and therefore maybe could look monstrous. And the nobleman obviously has his own desires because he's just lost authority. He's lost his crown. His crown's been usurped. So his whole plan is to get his crown back. And the native of the island, sadly, is sucked up into his plan, but then he changes his whole life. And so that's really what, you know, it's just the story of Caliban. I mean, Shakespeare, I think, is brilliant because I think he stages the problem. He's not really for or against any side, because I think what's noticeable is that Caliban is given poetic and sort of exalted language, which usually Shakespearean heroes have.
And as you conceive works, do they change as you start rehearsals with the dancers? And how much do the dancers help generate the work?
Well, in choreography, unlike, say, if you're a theatre director, you go into the studio with a text. In choreography, you don't have a text. You've got to create this text and then interpret it, if you like. So that phase of choreography, movement generation, you can do it two ways. You can either go in and have it all made on yourself, and then you need a mirror and say, OK, 5, 6, 7, 8, this is what we're all going to do together. Or you can do what I do, which is create tasks which the dancers then attend to. And so the dance text is created from what the dancers show you. So you're choosing. So somebody might show you 5 minutes of something. You may not choose anything there. Somebody else might show you 5 minutes. They might choose 10 seconds, which you then take in. So actually, it's like having words given to you, but then it's your job to create the sentence, find the grammar, you know, make the chapter and write the book. I think for me, I prefer it because I think when you finish your work, the performers own that piece. So I think for me, it's important that it's authentic to them and they feel like they own that work.
Tell me about the final choice of music, Shobhana.
This is the music that actually I chose for this piece that I made for historic churches called Two Mortal. James McMillan kindly gave me permission to remix this piece of music, Tenebrae Responsories. As you can probably imagine from a lot of my choices, I do like liturgical music for a simple reason in that it's meant for a building. There's a kind of harmony in like purpose and structure and architecture all coming together. And it's divorced from whatever emotion the person who's creating it might be feeling at that time. You know, it's independent. At the very end, he uses a solo voice, very much like Indian music would use a solo voice, in that the voice travels over many notes. You know, it's a very decorative way of using the voice.
Shobhanajaya Singh, thank you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Jesum tradidit impius from the Tenebrae responses by Sir James McMillan. The 16 were conducted by Harry Christophers, and that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the choreographer Shobhana Jayasinghe. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest is the playwright Michael Sherman.
Welcome back to the home of the oxymoron. Evil genius!
Ever the showman, he asked the newspaper to print his obituary early so he could enjoy it.
That's like hiding at your own funeral. Yeah, 100%. It'd be a great gig.
Yeah. I'm Russell Cain. Join me to weigh in on whether the biggest players in history are more evil or genius.
Becoming that rich, I'd say that is some level of genius.
It also helps that it's a long time ago, yeah. Right?
It's like the podcast version of telling your kids the ice cream van plays music when it's out of ice cream. Yes, it's evil. Yes, it's genius. Listen to Evil Genius on BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea, here to guide you through the afternoon and evening on Radio 3. Classical music comes face-to-face with artificial intelligence in our Sunday feature this evening. The British composer Tarek O'Regan is now based in San Francisco, so he's at the sharp end of it. And in the programme, he reports from Silicon Valley on how AI is likely to affect him and his fellow composers. You can hear that at 7:15 this evening. Now, it's 1:30. Time for us to join Sarah Moore Peach for our Sunday afternoon musical journey.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the programme where we paint a picture in music with a single piece in the foreground and a host of connected sounds from across history as its backdrop, framing it, colouring it, giving it perspective. Today our subject is a mythical bird floating on the waters that surround the Island of the Dead. The Swan of Tuonela, a standalone tone poem by the Finnish composer Jean Sibelius that forms part of a suite telling the story of the hero Lemminkainen from the Finnish epic The Kalevala. This ethereal music, both beautiful and ominous, is our destination in this music map, and we'll be hearing the full tone poem at the end of our listening journey. Let's begin that journey now with an encounter with another mythical swan gliding on a lake.